Well, welcome to the Second Court of Appeals. If some of you haven't been here in a while, we do have a new justice. Sitting with Justice Walker and I is now Justice Bill Meyer.
Good afternoon.
All right, we have two cases on our 130 docket. We have Joe Kaufman versus Islamic Society, and then we'll have Trimble versus State of Texas. If the clerk will please announce the attorneys for the first case. All right. Mr. Bowling.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good afternoon, Honorable Justices. May it please the Court, Brandon Bowling for Plaintiff Joe Kaufman, Defendant Joe Kaufman. I've been messing around with Appellant and Appellee here for a while, and I constantly mix them up, so I'll probably try to just call him Mr. Kaufman if that's okay with the Court. There has been a lot of briefing submitted in this matter, and I don't intend to stand here and just go over the briefs with you. I would like to focus the Court's attention on four particular matters where I would like to focus my argument today before you, because I see them as the four key points to whether or not Mr. Kaufman will be successful in his appeal. The first issue is whether or not Mr. Kaufman qualifies as a media defendant pursuant to Texas law. Secondly, whether or not the plaintiffs in this matter, the appellees, have standing because Mr. Kaufman's statements themselves were not of and concerning any plaintiff in this matter. Therefore, they don't have standing to assert any particular injury in order to recover in this matter. Third, Mr. Kaufman's statements are not defamatory. And lastly, which I will touch upon probably most briefly, is the relief that the plaintiffs are seeking in the form of an injunction. We assert that that is an unconstitutional prior restraint on Mr. Kaufman's speech, certainly in a defamation case where the speech should be sanctioned after it is spoken, not before it is spoken. Really what this case is about, because there are no damages, excluding nominal damages, is an attempt by the plaintiffs to muzzle Mr. Kaufman because they do not like what he had to say in the context of a debate that has very, very far-reaching implications for the American public in general, and it's terrorism. We agree that this is a case of first impression where we are asking for a media defendant status to be applied for somebody who is a journalist that writes almost exclusively as part of the internet. But I would assert to you that what we are asking you to do is certainly nothing outrageous, and it is certainly nothing new, and it's been something that's been going on in Texas for well over 100 years, when you had a telegraph become replaced by a telephone, and in this particular instance, you have print media exclusively, radio, you have movies, you have TV, you have cable television, all coming into play, technology morphs. All we are asking you to do is apply existing defamation law to the facts of this case to find that Mr. Kaufman is in fact a media defendant. If you look at the affidavit that Mr. Kaufman submitted in this matter, it is very clear and it is not refuted by the plaintiffs that Mr. Kaufman is a full-time investigative journalist who writes primarily for an online newspaper magazine called Front Page Magazine. It has a readership of over 500,000 people at least per month. Mr. Kaufman is a credentialed journalist. This is not refuted. And Mr. Kaufman conducted extensive journalistic research prior to writing an article that referred to the Islamic Circle of North America in relation to an event called Muslim Family Day. I would note for you that the Islamic Circle of North America is not a plaintiff in this matter. Neither is the Islamic Association of Northern Texas, who Mr. Kaufman also briefly referred to in his article. And I would direct your attention to the point that not one of the plaintiff entities are referenced at all by name, nor any individual member, by Mr. Kaufman in his article.
What specifically makes him different from me going on to anybody's webpage or blogging if I go on there every day and make a blog or, you know, respond to somebody else's blog?
Well, I don't think from a defamation law standpoint, Your Honor, that it makes you any different. I would assert to you that if that were the particular facts that were before the particular court that was hearing that issue, they could apply the existing defamation law to that particular factual scenario and come up with an appropriate determination as to whether or not that person is a media defendant. Here, it's uncontroverted if you look at the affidavit Mr. Kaufman filed, which was not refuted, that Mr. Kaufman is a full-time investigative journalist who just happens to publish his news pieces in an online capacity. I guess kind of what we're looking at in this instance, Your Honor, is look at what the communication is, not the vehicle of communicating the ideas that are contained within that article. I would think it's similar to say that you could properly put the media defendant analysis to a person who might appear in front of the World Trade Center in New York City if CNN is out broadcasting live in front, and that person comes in front of the camera and they say, you know, Mrs. Smith, what do you think about what's going on at the United Nations today? And she says, Brandon Bowling is a murderer. Well, just because that statement was made through a, you know, reputed news entity, through one of their news broadcasts, CNN, doesn't necessarily mean that that particular statement is going to make the person who uttered it or published it a media defendant for purposes of defamation law. If you look at what standards should be applied to a media defendant, I think it's pretty clear that Mr. Kaufman is not somebody who just wants to, you know, as the plaintiffs assert, engage in an unfettered, slanderous remark campaign on an internet web page. They have made a lot of hay in their arguments about Front Page Magazine being Mr. Kaufman's personal weblog. It is anything but Mr. Kaufman's personal weblog. You can look at Mr. Kaufman's original declaration for that. You can look at Mr. Kaufman's secondary declaration. You can look at the declaration submitted by Mr. Horowitz. Front Page Magazine has an editorial staff. They screen the articles. They only publish articles in a fashion similar to the review process that would take place at an actual newspaper. If you want to assume that what the plaintiffs are arguing is true, anybody who published anything on the internet would not get the protections of defamation law as we stand here solely because it was published on the internet. You could have a New York Times journalist who writes an article for the New York Times, publish it on a piece of paper in a daily edition of the New York Times that goes out, receiving protection as a media defendant, yet that same person, if he published his article in the New York Times online, potentially would not receive any of the same protections that he would receive had he actually submitted it for the print edition instead of the online edition.
So do we consider whether they're a compensated person? Is that a factor we look to?
I mean, I think that's a factor you could consider, but I don't think it's the exclusive or the dispositive factor. I think that you would need to look at the law as it sits in what is and what is not a media defendant for definitional purposes, apply that jurisprudence to the facts at hand to make a determination as to whether or not that particular person fits within a media defendant status. I mean, if you're familiar with online newspapers, you know, if you go on to, you know, the Star Telegram or whatever, sometimes you'll see that you have the ability to comment as a citizen on an article that's been published on the online edition of the newspaper. And you would be shocked to see what appears sometimes in those comment sections. You know, I'm not saying that everybody who writes something in any print source receives the protections that a media defendant would receive. I'm just saying that in the situation similar to Mr. Kaufman's, he should not be excluded from media defendant protection solely because he chooses to publish his journalistic work through the media that is the internet instead of a traditional print type of of a newspaper.
So was it his burden to conclusively establish as a matter of law that he was a media defendant?
I believe that's an issue of law for the court to decide based upon the facts that are before it. We believe that there is enough evidence before this court from the summary judgment record to find that Mr. Kaufman is a media defendant. If you look and see how he operates and how he conducts himself as a traditional print media journalist would. I mean, he doesn't say sensationalistic things. He doesn't shoot from the hip. He researches from a newsworthy standpoint, from a journalistic standpoint, and then he publishes. He just happens to publish on Front Page Magazine, which runs on the internet. And I mean, I think that if you follow the news, it's pretty evident that a lot of newspapers are completely going out of business. Up in Ann Arbor, Michigan, where I am from, the Ann Arbor News just went completely and exclusively online. So, I mean, if you want to follow what the plaintiff's logic is, none of those previously employed print journalists would receive protections as a media defendant because where they choose to work happens to publish their statements in an online capacity instead of in a print capacity. And I think that that's where the Texas law has been, you know, somewhat forward moving in this area, because way back in, you know, 1900, I think, was that case that was cited in the brief about the telegraph versus the telephone. Technology changes. You know, we're not asking anything outrageous. All we're asking is the law as it stands right now be applied to Mr. Kaufman for a determination that he is a media defendant, because except for the fact that he published it on the internet, and the statute doesn't say internet, the argument is he doesn't qualify as a media defendant. We don't find that to be, you know, an application of the law in the manner consistent in which it's intended to protect free speech and the debate within the American society and the marketplace of ideas. I guess what we're asking is that you don't necessarily focus on the medium in which the communication is made. Focus on the communication itself. And then to revert back to the question, Your Honor, that you asked me at the beginning, you know, I can't tell you whether or not somebody should be a media defendant in every case just because they happen to post something on the internet. But I can tell you that if you apply the defamation law as it currently exists to the communication in this case or to a communication that takes place in any other case, you will be able to make a reasoned determination based upon jurisprudence that's been in place for a long time to apply the correct standard to protect that particular person based upon his communications. San Antonio Railway was the name of the telegraph case. You can see from our brief there are other cases that support this premise, not necessarily from Texas, but kind of scattered throughout, you know, the United States. I mean, you're talking the Dunn case from the Supreme Court, the Garcia case, which is a Tenth Circuit case. You know, there have been numerous law review articles and commentaries that deal with this issue, but I think probably what would be the most applicable outside jurisdiction case to consider here would be two Fifth Circuit decisions that hold the Texas Supreme Court, even though it hasn't ruled on it yet, would likely provide media defendant protection to somebody in a position similar to Mr. Kaufman. The second point I would like to discuss, if it's okay to move on from the first one, is the standing issue. Mr. Kaufman's statements were not of and concerning any plaintiff in this matter. It is the plaintiff's burden to prove that Mr. Kaufman's statements actually referred to them, and it has to be an actual ascertainable individual who was defamed. That is the plaintiff's burden. They have no evidence except self-serving assertions and innuendos to say that they were defamed or even referred to in any capacity, because not one of them was even mentioned in this article. You know, the consistent argument through our briefs is the two entities who were mentioned, the Islamic Circle of North America and the IANT, are not parties to this action. We would assert that that's likely based upon Mr. Kaufman's research, because truth is a defense to a defamation claim. When you want to discuss the group libel doctrine, even if there was an identification of a plaintiff entity, if particular members of the plaintiff entity were not identified, it is still not of and concerning these particular plaintiffs. And again, no plaintiff was referenced by Mr. Kaufman. No individual persons in plaintiff entities were mentioned by Mr. Kaufman. And if you look back through the record, I don't even think that the plaintiffs could even prove to you who and who is not a member of their entities because they don't maintain membership roles. I could walk in here today and tell you that I'm a member of any one of the seven plaintiff entities, and they couldn't tell you if that was a true statement or not. Probably the most relevant and on-point case that deals with this issue here today.
You can complete your sentence. Go ahead.
Is the Harvest House case, and I would ask that you spend ample time referring to the Harvest House case because it is directly on point and there is no real possible way that the plaintiffs can get outside of Harvest House. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Bowling. Mr. Kaitzer.
Thank you. May it please the court. My name is Jeff Kaitzer, and I represent the appellees in this case. The appellees in this case basically are the recognized mosques in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. And let me address briefly, if I might, the latter part of Mr. Bowling's argument with respect to the issue of and concern. He claims that the statements that were made were not of or concerning my clients. And I think that that is not necessarily the test in a case where you have a group libel case. In the case that we've cited in our brief called Szilard versus Express News Corporation, a member of a small group has a cause of action for a defamatory statement if the statement refers to any and all or all members of the group, and this is the key point, and if those who know the plaintiff understand the article refers to the plaintiff. This is not some sort of diabolical terrorist plot to bring down the government of the United States. And that's really what Mr.
In that case, it specifically mentioned a small group. And the plaintiff was actually a single person, right? The plaintiff
yes.
they were referring to, which is kind of a different scenario than what we have here.
Well, I guess the question is, what is a small group and who are the people who are aware of what the small group is?
But I think the case that you mentioned is really applying not group libel but to a particular individual, but that was identifiable by reference to a group, which is not what we don't have any particular individuals identifiable here.
That's correct, but the law is, I believe, that you can libel an entity like a corporation, or in this case, my clients are basically Texas corporations. They are religious organizations, mosques.
Isn't that part of the problem is that it's just too broad? I mean, could you have a libel action brought by all Christians or brought by all? I mean, isn't the group too large?
It would be our position, Justice Walker, that it's not, because the focus can be narrowed down to those identifiable entities who have brought this suit.
Okay, tell me which entities are identifiable from the statements.
The entities that are identifiable from the statements would be those entities that are involved in the sponsorship of basically Muslim Family Day at Six Flags. Everybody has the right to go and have a nice day at Six Flags. This is a group outing that Six Flags sanctioned, sponsored, wanted to have people come in and enjoy the day at Six Flags, just like they do for churches, synagogues, Boy Scouts, whomever. And the identifiable groups, I believe, can be found on Exhibit A1 in our brief. And it says that these are sponsored by the Dallas-Fort Worth area. All Dallas-Fort Worth area, basically mosques and Islamic centers, another word for mosque. And it lists where you can get tickets available. Our lead plaintiff, for example, in Arlington, at the Islamic Society of Arlington. That's basically the Arlington Mosque. Our one of the individuals who signed the pleadings and who signed the summary judgment proof on behalf of the Islamic Society of Arlington, Jamal Kadura, is a member of the community, and he signed the pleadings in this case and signed summary judgment proof on behalf of Islamic Society of Arlington, which is the, in essence, known as the Arlington Mosque. And if you look at this particular document, you can see this is Muslim Family Day. This isn't Jihad in Texas Day. This is a group of Muslims, co-religionists, who went together and who get discount tickets because Six Flags lets them do that because they have a group. And they're going to go out and have a, basically ride rides and have a picnic. And in the meantime, what we have now is, then we talk about where are the statements. Where do the statements identify the plaintiffs? If you look at the basically the first paragraph in the article, the last sentence says, while most of the patrons of the park come for the games and rides, those involved with this group's event, Muslim Family Day, may very well have found an original and appealing way to spread anti-Western hatred. Those involved can easily be determined by looking at Muslim Family Day flyer, Exhibit A1 to our brief. It says, the local mosques. That's who is involved in the case. So it doesn't take much for a person who knows the plaintiffs in this instance, which are the Dallas and Fort Worth mosques, which are individual corporations in the state of Texas, chartered under the state of Texas as corporations, to know that these are the legal personages involved in the case and involved in these statements. The article, moreover, goes on to state further, in basically the next to last paragraph, of the article, IGNA's Muslim Family Day will occur on October 14th. Is nothing but a charade created to spread hatred, but veiled in a way to make the sponsoring organization look harmless. The sponsors are the mosques of Dallas-Fort Worth, and they're listed. Several of my clients are listed as being where tickets can be purchased. Those in the Muslim community to whom this was directed were planning on having a nice day out with the family. And on the contrary, on this particular blog that Mr. Kaufman writes, if we continue looking at that same paragraph that I just directed your attention to.
I'm sorry, I'm not seeing which paragraph it is. It's in your Exhibit C, right?
Exhibit D is easier to read.
Okay.
It's a typed up version.
Okay.
It's easier to read. I had the same problem. That's why we attached it. It's the last on the second page of Exhibit D, where it says IGNA's Muslim Family Day.
Okay.
Is where I was reading.
Thank you.
From. It's talking about the sponsoring organization. And then you move to the next page as that paragraph continues. It talks about fifth columns within our borders who wish to do us harm. Well, clearly everyone knows what fifth columnists are. It comes from the Spanish Civil War. It talks about how basically traitors in your midst will arise to bring down the defenses of the city. I think the city was Madrid, if my history serves me correct. But basically the term fifth columnist is nothing more than accusing an entity, a person, of being a traitor. And that's exactly the gist of this article. And this article makes reference to the organizations that are sponsoring this group, and so this event, those involved with this group's event, Muslim Family Day. I can think of nothing more non-traitorous than having a Family Day sponsored by a religious organization at Six Flags. Now, if I could, I'd like to go back to Mr. Bowling's initial argument. What is a journalist is what we are talking about here, and basically, what is media? I would submit to the court that media is that which conducts. That's what the particular statute that we're talking about here. And remember, it's our position in this case that at this point, the only reason why we're even plausibly here is because the statute provides for an interlocutory appeal for a media defendant. Okay. a media defendant, what is media? Media is that which conducts it. A newspaper, a television broadcast, a magazine, something like that. We're not talking about statements that are made. Mr. Bowling talked about how someone could accuse him of murder, and that wouldn't enable him to bring a suit against the quote-unquote media. It wouldn't give that person who accused him of murder media protections. Although I would submit to the court that it might give the network that actually did broadcast that some degree of protection. And that is exactly right, because there are certain principles that we have in jurisprudence that recognizes the need for certain professions governed by professional standards to have special protections. We do that in the field of medicine. To a lesser degree, we might do that for attorneys and accountants, because you have to have certain kinds of expert testimony to get anywhere. In this case, we have it for media, and in particular print and broadcast media, because you've got editorial boards, you've got journalistic standards, you've got some ascertainable standard for a profession that theoretically needs to be adhered to before you can take advantage, preliminarily at least, of the right to appeal interlocutorily. And that's what brings us here today. Basically, there is no guidance for this court that Mr. Bowling has put forward that identifies who is a media defendant. With this scenario, basically, if you make a YouTube video and put it on YouTube, are you a media defendant? Are you entitled to those same protections?
I thought that I heard Mr. Bowling urge, although not directly, but the aspects of subscription of the publication and whether or not it's the person's exclusive job and the investigation put into it and whether or not they're credentialed and aspects such as that, which are considered in other areas of defamation law.
I suppose that may be the case, but there really wasn't. And I suppose if that's the standard he wants this court to adopt, I suppose this court and this, I agree with Mr. Bowling on one thing. This is kind of a case of first impression. This is an interesting case, an interesting lawsuit. But I think that, to answer your question, Justice Walker, that's precisely why the appellant did not make such a showing at the trial court with respect to the motion for summary judgment. That's why we've had a flurry of filings of other declarations outside the summary judgment record that have come into this court, which we've objected to, because they realized tacitly, I think, the filing of these affidavits or declarations or whatever you want to call them, they realized that, well, they maybe didn't have that evidence before the court. They didn't
but
have the...
Was that evidence relevant to the summary judgment? In other words, the defendant really didn't have to show in the trial court that they were a media defendant in order to pursue a motion for summary judgment. And I'm just wondering if since we can determine our own jurisdiction, we have a duty to determine our own jurisdiction. Can we consider those affidavits here? And what's your position on that?
I don't think those affidavits should be considered here, because there hasn't been adequate time for discovery on the whole issue of who he is and what he is and what those journalistic standards are. We have Mr. Bowling making statements about what his credentials are. Those weren't necessarily before the trial court, nor was the existence of hits. And this is another area that troubles me.
It's problematic.
The evidence, both in the summary judgment and as referred to in the brief, somehow you become a public figure or you become this or become that by the number of hits on Google or on Yahoo.
Well, let me ask you this. Is it your position that we have to resolve the media defendant issue first, that we have to resolve the motion to dismiss first or not?
If the court determines that there's not sufficient evidence to show that he is entitled to appeal based upon the statute to an interlocutory appeal, then that is a way that this court could determine this case summarily and just simply send the court back to the trial judge, Judge Curry, for further proceedings or for other motions after discovery, since they're raising sort of new fact issues now before this court.
But what if we were to decide the standing issue at the same time and to determine that your clients didn't have standing? Then it's a tie of no jurisdiction and no jurisdiction.
Well, that's
another problem.
That's an interesting problem. That's correct, Justice Livingston. That it is an interesting problem. And I don't know that I have the answer to that question, because it is sort of a question of first impression. Is the person, because depending upon, as the court knows, based upon defamation cases, I'll lump them all together, that there are certain thresholds that must be met depending upon whether a defendant is involved in the media or whether or not he's making those statements as a private citizen, or whether possibly it's a combination of the two. You can be a journalist passing out, in effect, handbills. Does that give you media protection? Effectively, maybe the internet is nothing more than a 21st century way of putting out handbills. Does that give you media protection? I don't think so.
But doesn't it involve more what the communication is? I mean, I'm not sure that you can classify any individual as always a media defendant or always not a media defendant. A journalist could go out and write a personal blog and lose their status as a media defendant.
And
I mean, a full-time journalist for the New York Times. Or you could have someone who's not normally a journalist who writes a one-time commentary article, a visiting op-ed piece for a newspaper that qualifies as a media defendant in that particular situation, but never again in their life.
And that's the problem that we have here. The extension that Mr. Bowling wishes this court to undertake is to basically obliterate that and potentially give virtually anyone who posts things on the internet the right to claim that that person is a media defendant, as that term is understood in the statute and in the common law. And that's an extension that I don't think that the Supreme Court of Texas has done thus far. And that's why we oppose it, among other things.
Mr. Cater, your time is up.
That's good, because I've run out of things to say.
Well, thank you. All right, Mr. Bowling, your rebuttal.
Thank you, Justice Livingston. I will try not to talk too fast in my 5 minutes.
That's all right.
Pay attention to grammar when you are reading Mr. Kaufman's article. He has singled out one group, the Islamic Circle of North America, and then secondarily mentions the IANT. But if you look on page, I think it's 5 of our secondary brief, you will see all of the singular references to ICNA. Even if you listen to what Mr. Cater just said, everything he talked about was sponsors of this group's event. This group, singular, is ICNA. That was the target of Mr. Kaufman's affidavit and his article, which you can see by reading his affidavit. The Sellard case obviously is distinguishable because you're talking about four individual persons in a car and three of them are dead and there's only one left alive who's named in this article. This is different than a massive Dallas mosque that can't account for the number of members it even has in it. Even if you look at the evidence that Mr. Cater is directing you to show you why it's of and concerning the plaintiffs in this matter, none of them are listed there. It's all Dallas-Fort Worth mosques. I argue the standard is not a subjective determination based upon what reader might see it. It's a reasonable determination made by the objective reader, and case law that's cited in our brief supports that position, even where, subjectively, somebody has determined that it refers to them. If you look at Mr. Horowitz's declaration, Mr. Kaufman's second declaration, and you look at Mr. Kaufman's first declaration, which was submitted to the trial court, there was no short-sightedness on the part of Mr. Kaufman regarding whether or not he needed to show enough information to prove he was a media defendant. Read Mr. Kaufman's initial affidavit, and you will see that Mr. Kaufman is a full-time investigative journalist focusing primarily on terrorism, has been writing for national publications since 1995, writes regularly for Front Page Magazine. Front Page Magazine is a national publication which focuses mainly on issues of politics and terrorism and has a monthly readership of approximately 500,000 people. That was, in effect, before Judge Curry, and was not solicited here. The only reason the additional affidavits were solicited here was to rebut the arguments that the plaintiffs made, which were outside of the record in their opposition brief to our opening brief. That's the basis for why those affidavits were submitted. pay close attention to the fatal inconsistencies of the arguments regarding defamation liability that the plaintiffs are making out of both sides of their mouth. They want to argue that they were defamed by implication, but they want to argue that nobody has ever heard of them and that they're private figure plaintiffs. Quotes from their briefs say, "The appellees in this case were readily identifiable members of the group of sponsors and participation at the Six Flag event to support their position that so everybody would know that Mr. Kaufman's article referred to them to support their defamation argument. Later in their brief, to support the argument that they're not public figures to get away from the actual malice standard, they argue that it is doubtful that most people in the Dallas-Fort Worth Metroplex had heard of any appellee organization. Appellees are not household names. They can't have it both ways. They can't be defamed by implication if they've never been heard of, and if they've been heard of because they injected themselves into this public controversy by associating themselves with ICNA, they should have found better friends in the first place, because it's pretty clear from Mr. Kaufman's article that ICNA can legitimately be tied to terror, and if they are public figures by injecting themselves into that controversy, the actual malice standard applies. They can't have it both ways. They aren't, you know, unknown, and they're not so well known to get the standards they want." Thank you, Justices.
Thank you, gentlemen. Appreciate your arguments today and your excellent briefing. Your case is submitted. You all are now excused.